From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what the governor wants and what state lawmakers will give. They're shaping the 2019 budget right now in Lansing.
Medicaid has really become a flashpoint between Republicans in the legislature and this Republican governor.
Can safe injection sites help in the war on drugs and disease in Grand Rapids?
Providing that service within the city has had a huge impact on the HIV epidemic.
Native Americans fight to reclaim their ancestors' remains for museums and libraries.
For Anishinaabe people, it's so important for us to retrieve our ancestors, and it's work many of us do from different tribal nations throughout the Great Lakes. It's something we do every day. We work on this every day.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. And now the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some experts say it is worth exploring safe injection sites in Michigan, places where users can inject drugs under medical supervision. We'll discuss the value of these sites in the fight against the opioid crisis later in the hour. But first, state lawmakers continue plugging away at crafting a budget for 2019. The House passed its budget bills April 24th. The Senate's bills passed last Thursday. And now comes the task of ironing out differences between the two. Let's see what that might look like as we welcome Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta and from Gongwer News Service, Zach Gorchow. Rick, remind us again, just where are we now in the budget process and what kind of timetable are lawmakers working under?
Well, one of the innovations of the Snyder administration, which means, you know, the past 7 years, has been that the budget doesn't wait until the state's fiscal year begins on October 1st. Governor Snyder and the Republican House and the Republican Senate have, as a practical matter, aligned Michigan's budget cycle with the budget cycle of community colleges, universities, school districts, local governments, all of which have fiscal years that begin on July 1st, which means that we are getting into the home stretch of finalizing the budget.
Certainly helps with planning, so all of these institutions know the kind of money that's coming. So, Zach, when we think about the fact that we've got these two versions, how different are the House and Senate versions of the budget?
The House and Senate versions aren't extremely different. I mean, there's a couple points where there's some notable differences. I think you look at the corrections budget has to be a big one. Big issue there. Prison food service. The Snyder administration has called for having that run by state employees again. That's been outsourced for a number of years. The legislature can't stop the Snyder administration from bringing that back in-house, but they can choose whether or not to provide the additional funding that the Snyder administration says is necessary to do that. The House has basically gone along with that, but the Senate, which has clashed with the department for many years, has not. And there's a whole other series of issues in the department. The Senate wants to see about putting up for bid some nursing services.
Yep.
So there's a lot of disagreement in that budget in particular. But by and large, the House and Senate are sort of coming at it in a lot of the same way. You can see some differences in the university budget. The Senate's put more money in to sort of provide carrots and sticks, so to speak, on campus sexual assault policies. But the real big difference is the legislature and the governor. And really, if you look at what the big difference, and it appears the legislature is using words like dead, would be the tipping fee, the increase in the tipping fee the Snyder administration has proposed.
The governor wants that.
Yeah. So let's talk about, because I think to the common person,
no
the
one
tipping,
knows
fee,
what a tipping fee is.
Exactly. Not top of mind for most of us.
Well, and actually, in the 3 decades that I have been covering state government, tipping fees have been a huge controversial issue. They're dumping fees, the fees that garbage haulers pay to landfills to dump. And Michigan's are pretty low, which is a benefit to municipal governments and businesses that pay the fees, whether they are in Michigan or in another state, or even north of the border in Canada.
Thus, we get those trucks from Canada.
The governor has developed an infrastructure strategy that he would like to leave as part of his legacy. Remember, he's done at the end of this year. And one of the ways that he would pay for it is to bring these landfill tipping fees closer to the market rate. Not all the way up there, but
not
closer.
So bargain basement.
But Republicans for generations preceding this governor have said absolutely not to
what?
That. Pro-business.
Pro-business, period.
The state of Michigan in 1998, voters approved hundreds of millions of dollars in bonds to clean up so-called brownfields. Those monies are now basically exhausted.
Right.
And this is the governor's idea of finding a revenue source to continue that work.
And deal with the new ones that are coming out, like the chemical contamination that's commonly known as PFAS, these emerging environmental problems.
But the word dead has been used for that.
Yes. and it was used pretty much close to the moment that he rolled it out.
Okay. What about some other big differences between what the governor asked for and what lawmakers are willing to do?
Well, another big one is he's proposed a fee that would be attached to residents' water bills to create some money for water infrastructure. I mean, everybody knows how all the problems we're having with water main breaks, whether it's something in Flint like replacing lead service lines, or really anywhere.
It's Macomb County.
Aging piece of infrastructure throughout the state. Again, this is one that the legislature has not included the revenue from that in its budget. The word debt has been thrown around. Others will say, well, we'll deal with these ideas later, but not as part of the budget process, which is probably code for saying it's dead. But the governor, this has been something he put a lot of emphasis on, and there really isn't, not that this would be a huge scale, but there isn't a large-scale state revenue mechanism for water infrastructure. It's really put upon local taxpayers and local ratepayers.
And there really was a hope on the part of the administration that because of the attention paid to the Flint water crisis, to the giant crater in Macomb County, that there might at least be the will to adopt these fees or something like it.
Be open.
In order to do something about water infrastructure, which it does seem that this is a moment where the public is really interested in that.
Well, roads and water.
Yeah.
I think the public's there. Zach, what does the final version passed by the House and Senate, what does that have for people losing their Healthy Michigan eligibility?
So the state has been letting folks know they will be losing eligibility for Healthy Michigan, which is the expanded Medicaid program, if they have not complied with the healthy behavior requirement. And if they haven't done that, they're going to be moved off of Healthy Michigan, and they'll have to purchase something through the health insurance exchanges. But the governor has proposed several tens of millions of dollars, maybe about $60 million if I recall, to cover the costs of this. And the legislature, the Republicans specifically in the legislature, are none too pleased with this. I think they felt like, hey, wait a second, we never agreed that the state was going to fund the purchase of insurance for people who didn't comport with the requirements.
Sort of defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
Sure.
So the legislature has not agreed to that funding, and I don't know how that one's going to turn out.
Yeah, I don't know either. Medicaid has really become a flashpoint between Republicans in the legislature and this Republican governor. Healthy Michigan is a marquee accomplishment of the Snyder administration, that the governor considers it part of his legacy. He thinks that it's good for people because it improves health outcomes. He thinks that it's good for taxpayers and for health consumers because it reduces the cost of coverage, because people aren't going to emergency rooms to get treated when a crisis hits. But we're seeing, you know, now the Medicaid work requirement is hanging out there, that Senate Republicans want to put a 48-month time limit on Healthy Michigan benefits. And so we're seeing those negotiations hanging out there.
And this governor is gone at the end of the year, so next time round, who knows?
Who knows, yeah.
When you look at these House and Senate budgets, Rick, what do you see as priorities for Democrats and the priorities for Republicans?
Well, why are we talking about the priorities for Democrats?
Because it doesn't matter, does it? Truly. There's nothing can be done much, right?
I mean, I'm being facetious,
yeah.
But
majority is a majority.
You know, I mean, Democrats put out their priorities, but basically their talking points for election debates as opposed to
what are we hearing?
Zach, I'm going to punt to you on that.
That's fine. The big thing they're emphasizing is road funding, because obviously the roads are in dreadful condition throughout many parts of the state. And this is something where the Republicans and the governor as well have resisted following suit. You know, you remember now they did put in some extra money into the current year budget for roads. It was at about $150-160 million, if I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And the upcoming budget for the 2018-19 fiscal year calls for $150 million from the general fund to go into roads in addition to what the new or increased taxes and fees are generating. But the Democrats are saying, hey, wait a second. You know, the state's sitting on almost $1 billion in its rainy day fund. Some would say that the roads are clearly an instance where it's raining, that the combination of multiple freeze thaws toward the end of the winter, flooding rains, created especially bad pothole season, road crack up, and more money needs to be put into roads on that basis. And the Republicans have resisted that. So it's become a point the Democrats
have. Yeah, it's a proposal without a consequence because the Democrats know that that's never going to happen. Because in fact, that's not what the Rainy Day Fund was created for. The Rainy Day Fund is created to help carry the state through a mild recession without having to make big changes to programs. Another thing that we're hearing about that Democrats think is a powerful election point is debating funding for K-12 schools versus charters versus virtual schools and mixed university funding into that as well.
Bottom line, Rick, your take first. Biggest winners, biggest losers in the House and Senate budgets.
Ooh, obviously it depends on what the final version of the budget looks like, but I think it depends on whether or not Republicans get their privatization wishes, money for virtual schools and things like that.
Any thoughts, Zach?
When you get down to it, these budgets that come out of the House and Senate, in a way, are talking points themselves. You know, so much of this will change once the final negotiations get underway with the governor. I mean, the tipping fee increase we talked about, the water bill fee, you know, does the governor actually go to the mat for any of that stuff, or does he allow it to disappear into the ether?
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta and from Gongwer News Service, Zach Gorchow. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing the heavy lifting, Zach.
Coming up, a federal law passed almost 30 years ago required museums to return Native American remains to their descendants.
You would think, you would hope that the response would be, yes, how can we do this? What can we do? How can we work together to right this wrong? But unfortunately, that is not the case.
And today, thousands of human remains are still held in museums. That story next on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Museums and libraries around the country hold between 300 and 600,000 Native American human remains in their collections. In 1990, the federal government passed the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, known as NAGPRA. This law required certain Native American remains to be handed over to culturally affiliated tribes or provable descendants, but by no means did that law result in all of those human remains being given back. My guests today are part of a team that came up with a special way to explain the tribal repatriation experience. It's a comic book titled Journeys to Complete the Work and Changing the Way We Bring Native American Ancestors Home. Sonia Attalay is here with us now. She's an archaeologist and a professor of anthropology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, a member of the National NAGPRA Committee, and author of this comic book. Sonia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we welcome Shannon Martin, who directs the Zibowing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways here in Michigan. She is Gun Lake Potawatomi and Ojibwe. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Miigwech. I'm happy to be here.
Sonia, before the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act was passed in 1990, what avenues, what options existed for tribes trying to bring their ancestors home for burial?
Well, the main thing that they could do was try to develop relationships and talk to and make pleas to, really, museums that held their ancestors. There was nothing formal. There was no law by which they could make that happen. So it was that relationship that mattered. And as we know, that very often did not happen. That just was not the case, that they were able to bring their ancestors home.
I'd like to follow up on that as well. And prior to the 1990 NAGPRA law, our sacred sites, burial grounds, were still being compromised. They were being desecrated and excavated professionally through various universities or private archaeological firms were sent in to do this type of desecration. And prior to that, even into the 1930s, 40s, 50s, some of our mounds here in the Midwest were excavated, they were opened up, and they were roadside attractions where you could pay 5 cents or 10 cents to pull off the side of the road and look into an open mound, earthen pit, to see burials of our ancestors.
Sonia, what did the law do? What did NAGPRA do?
Well, the law put in place several provisions that require people to consult with tribes so that they couldn't just simply, you know, excavate whatever they wanted to do. Now, that doesn't mean that those processes have stopped. What Shannon's talking about, for example, it's not that graves still aren't being excavated. They can be. And in fact, that's one of the things that we try to bring up in the work that we've done, which one of the important pieces of this is cultural affiliation. If archaeologists or state and federal agencies are required to consult, they're able to determine who it is that they should be consulting with. And as Native people, we can think, well, you should be consulting broadly with anyone who may have an affiliation with those ones who are buried in a particular place. But unfortunately, it's up to them to determine who it is that they're consulting with that they think there could be a connection or affiliation with. So we'd like to see state, federal agencies, institutions consulting broadly. Otherwise, they could just say, well, there's no one who's affiliated with these peoples, so we're just going to go ahead and excavate. And so that's a really important piece of this puzzle, that we think about how connections and affiliations look today.
Shannon, in the belief sense, explain the importance of returning ancestors to Mother Earth. And I'm particularly interested in what is the last giveaway ceremony.
Well, the last giveaway ceremony for us is the gift of our vessel, our body, the experience that we walked on this earth that carried our spirit, giving that back to Mother Earth to honor her for all that she gave to us.
That's interrupted when somebody's remains are in a library or a museum.
Exactly. It's interrupted. And that's why for Anishinaabe people, it's so important for us to retrieve our ancestors. And it's work many of us do from different tribal nations throughout the Great Lakes. It's something we do every day. We work on this every day.
And this comic book that you've put out, it tells the story of the transformation of a museum that was very resistant to returning remains and traveling items, artifacts. And it was the University of Michigan's Museum of Anthropological Archaeology in Ann Arbor. So what happened when the university was approached?
Between 2005 and 2008, we were requesting the return from three sites here in Michigan that were within the Aboriginal territory of the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan. Those sites were the Rivera Vaz site, the Bussinger site, and the Young site. We spent nearly 3 years with a consultation documentation grant from the National Park Service. So this grant was able to fund us to assemble a team of experts like Dr. Adelai, as well as tribal historians and spiritual elders, to come together to provide a justification. And we worked very diligently in researching and putting together our justification and providing the documentation that was needed under the law and through the consultation documentation funding. We presented the information, 2.5 years of extensive research by our team, and within 2 months we received a letter that rejected our claim, stating that the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan has no contemporary or modern day, we feel no modern connection to these ancestors. So therefore, you know, the university has rejected your claim for repatriation.
Was that initial U of M resistance typical or atypical?
Unfortunately, that initial resistance is quite typical. You would think, you would hope that the response would be, yes, how can we do this? What can we do? How can we work together to right this wrong? But unfortunately, that is not the case. Very often, institutions think of themselves as the stewards over these types of ancestral remains and these items.
And so they feel we need to hang on to these. We can't see them scattered to the winds or whatever. We need to know.
Yes, in fact, and I'll give the example of the other case in the comic was with Harvard University, and one of the comments that we received from the institution was, well, we are a museum after all, right? It's our job to hold, to store, to keep. And I think there are other institutions and that are now leading the way to say, no, that isn't the case. There can be other roles for museums. And we see that with the turnaround of the University of Michigan.
Let's talk about that turnaround, because that's really the centerpiece of this story. Shannon, how and why did the university's attitude change?
Well, it changed because we had to force it to change. Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan, with its tribal council and PR department, took a pretty firm stance that University of Michigan needed to hear from us, needed to hear our claim, because one or two individuals made the decision to reject our claim for the ancestors. So we decided to attend a Board of Regents meeting, get on their public commentary. Our PR director read a very impassioned statement to the Board of Regents, and we staged a press release and honor songs and elders saying and said prayers before we went into the Regents at the Cube. So the press was there. We released a statement talking about what the University of Michigan had done to the tribe and its fair and unjust treatment regarding NAGPRA. And we hoped that one regent or two regents would feel our pain, feel mm-hmm. our hardship in trying to do the right thing by our ancestors. And one or two did. And things began to change. A committee was put into place to investigate the relationship between the museum and Michigan tribes and other tribes. And from that point on, the person who was in charge of the Great Lakes collection was removed from his responsibility, and things started to move.
And as you point out in Journeys to Complete the Work, the University of Michigan is now like leading the pack in terms of returning items and remains. If you've just joined us, we are talking about the Journeys to Complete the Work and changing the way we bring Native American ancestors home, all about returning the remains of ancestors to their tribe so they could be properly buried. I'm talking with Shannon Martin, who is with the Zibewing Center. She directs it, the Zibewing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways here in Michigan, and Dr. Sonia Atale, who's a professor of anthropology and an archaeologist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and author of the comic book. So you tell this story in a comic book. Sonia, why a comic book?
Well, actually, some of the base of what I do is community-based research, which is just sitting down, working with communities, and finding out the kind of scholarship that they'd like us to do as academics. And I did this work in Turkey at a 9,000-year-old site that I worked at called Çatalhöyük. And when I went into people in the local village nearby there, a little village called Küçükköy, and I talked with local people who are mostly farmers, I said, well, what kind of things would you like to do? How would you like to learn about this 9,000-year-old site that's literally in your backyard? And one of the things they had talked about was that they would like comics to learn about it. And it made a lot of sense in that way. They said they were for their children, but what was really interesting was there's a pretty low literacy rate in these villages. A lot of the girls and boys don't have the ability to go to school beyond third grade. So for adults to learn about the site, of course, I'm not going to hand them a scholarly published article or a book. Comics were the perfect venue. There's visuals, and then the text is fairly minimal. So I worked with one of the other co-authors of the comic, John Swager, who was the illustrator on that site of Çatalhöyük, and we came up with a whole series of comics at that site. So I always say I can't claim this idea. It literally came from people in these villages. And it was actually during my work on the National NAGPRA Review Committee where I saw tribes coming forward struggling with really trying and fighting to reclaim their ancestral remains. It just occurred to me on that committee that this would be a really powerful and useful way to kind of mobilize that knowledge, get the knowledge out there.
So, Sonia, who did you write it for? As you authored this comic book, who did you have in mind as your reading audience?
I had a whole range of people. I mean, of course, in my mind, I was thinking, well, it could be for museums. It could be for students. I was hoping tribal nations would find it useful. But this has found success actually beyond my wildest dreams. And I actually kind of joke saying, I wish my book or any of the other scholarly things that I've written were getting this much interest. Thousands and thousands of copies being ordered. People using it across the nation to teach NAGPRA in their classrooms. And I think that's fantastic, these kind of engaged ways of getting knowledge out there. It's amazing to see how much interest there's been, and international interest as well.
And there it is, NAGPRA Comics number one, right? So it means that there's more to come. What was it about the Michigan story that made this the perfect vehicle, the perfect way to tell the story?
Well, the Michigan story, it was a difficult journey at first. NAGPRA and the spirit of the work, when it's done in true mutual respect, consultation, it can transform communities, it can transform an institution, and that's what it has done. And we believe the ancestors have helped compel that transformation, because now we are working together with the museum currently on developing a Black Ash Basket exhibition where we're going to share our collections, and students are going to work with the Zeeboink Center to design and develop that exhibition. We are also working with the Matai Botanical Gardens and with the museum and looking at repatriating ancestral heirloom seeds to try to grow them out and rematriate them back into our communities. There are some seeds within the ethnographic collections that are about 100 years old. So we would be possibly reintroducing some new food source ancestral seeds into the community. So, I mean, the opportunities that are beginning to emerge when we are working together with mutual respect are just endless, and it's exciting work that the tribes are doing with the University of Michigan now.
And late last year, there was a recommitment to the Earth ceremony, so the ancestors were brought home?
Yeah, we brought one site, the Gary site, home from the University of Michigan, and this was probably, I would say, since the adversarial relationship in 2000, you know, 5, 6, and 7, this was probably the fifth ancestral repatriation that we've accomplished together. And, you know, the work to effectuate these repatriations, it does take a long time because you're following a process, you're following a federal law. And this past repatriation was probably, we saw the largest delegation from the University of Michigan attend. About 20 people from U of M came up to Mount Pleasant to participate with us in the full day of ceremony and recommitment of these ancestors back into the earth.
Now, are there more to come?
There are more. We're about halfway done. The Michigan tribes working together under an organization called the Michigan Anishinaabe Cultural Repatriation and Protection Alliance. That alliance has been in existence since early 2000s. Late 90s, and working together with the University of Michigan, we're about halfway done. Their collections were extensive, one of the largest in the country. Just from Michigan, well over 1,600 to 1,700 ancestors were here and were pulled out of Michigan alone.
Sonia, when I think of that staggering number, that 300 to 600,000 Native American human remains, and that could be a conservative guesstimate, isn't it? Is having a prominent institution like the University of Michigan kind of at the forefront of this, will that spread? Will that help spread across the country?
Well, that's certainly the hope. And that's part of the hope of the comic, is that rather than to say, sometimes people have said, well, we can't get back these materials. It closes the door to research. That's what NAGPRA does. That's what repatriation does. It means the door is closed. We can't do any more research. And in fact, what we're trying to show with that comic, as Shannon was articulating, is that, in fact, this opens the door to research, but it's research that's done in a different way, work that's done in collaboration with tribes and in partnership, you know, things that matter and they can make a difference in Native communities' daily lives. So hopefully an institution like the University of Michigan taking such a prominent leadership role nationally and internationally to show how this can be done. And look what it's done. It opens the door to these amazing research projects that are really and truly cutting edge.
I'm actually flipping through Journeys to Complete the Work, looking at you guys, your comic avatars. What was that like when you first opened this book and went, oh my word, here I am. Here's Shannon Martin, and here's, what was that like for you guys?
It's amazing. It's humbling also, you know, for us to be part of the story and being featured in the comic. It is very humbling, but also, you know, it gives young people somebody, a face and a name and a real person to look up to say, hey, you know, if I'm looking at going into anthropology or archaeology or museum studies and doing this type of work and bringing my ancestors home, they have somebody that they can relate to.
Well, it's eye-opening. You don't have to be a museum person or a university person or a member of a tribe to read it and really, really have your eyes open. And we have put up the link so you too can view this comic book, Journeys to Complete the Work and Changing the Way We Bring Native American Ancestors Home. You can find it on the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. And we've been talking with Dr. Sonia Atale from the University of Massachusetts Amherst and Shannon Martin, Zibuwing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways here in Michigan. Thank you so much.
Miigwech. Thank you very much.
Miigwech. Thanks for your time and interest.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, the groundbreaking investigative journalist who committed herself to an insane asylum and changed the way the U.S. treated people who were mentally ill. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This past Saturday marked the 154th birthday of Nellie Bly. She's one of the first, if not the very first, American investigative journalist. And her willingness to be checked into the New York City Women's Insane Asylum helped change the way America treated people who were mentally ill. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is back with us now. Nellie Bly was the pen name of Elizabeth Cochran Seaman. How and when did she start her career in journalism?
Well, she took her name from a Stephen Foster song, Nellie Bly, although that's spelled N-E-L-L-Y, and because of a typo, her first byline was N-E-L-L-I-E, which she remained. She started out in Pittsburgh. She was born in a suburb of Pittsburgh, and she worked for the Pittsburgh Dispatch, and like many, or rather, there are very few women reporters, they were all assigned the society page, the gardening page, or things like home and hearth. And she got really bored writing about this stuff. So she convinced her editor to let her go to Mexico for 6 months, where she wrote about the culture and lives of Mexicans. And then when she came back, she decided she had enough. And she left a note to her family. I'm off for New York. Watch for my name, Nellie Bly.
Oh, that is so cool.
It is. Really, it's almost cinematic. Yeah.
So she talked her way into a job with the New York World.
Yes, which was then one of the greatest newspapers in the world. It was actually See the World by Reading the World. It was Joseph Pulitzer's flagship newspaper. Joseph Pulitzer, an odd bird himself, he was almost completely blind and no one could actually see him. He would speak through one person, through notes and such, but his mantra was accuracy, accuracy, accuracy. And she got into the city room and convinced the editors that she could do the job, and they came up with the idea of her being committed to the New York City's women's asylum on Blackwell's Island, which is now Roosevelt Island.
So how did she do that? How did she get herself committed?
Fascinating. She got herself admitted to a temporary woman's boarding house. There were all these cheap boarding houses where what we would call today the homeless, where people who were down and out could live for a small fee each night. They could rent a bed. And she found many crazy inmates there and watched them. She imitated them. She worked in front of a mirror so that she could make certain faces and gestures that would make her look insane. And then, lo and behold, within a few days, it worked. And so the matron of the boarding house called the police. She was escorted by two policemen to the Essex Street Police Courthouse. A judge named Duffy said, yep, you're nuts. Sent her off to Bellevue, to the famous Bellevue insane ward. There again, she was deemed insane, and she was boarded on a ferry to the asylum on Blackwell's Island, where somebody told her, you know, once you get on this island, you never get off.
Just like Hotel California, you can check in anytime you want, but you'll never leave.
Yeah.
So what kind of conditions did she find?
Horrid conditions. The food was inedible. People were crowded. There were 1,600 women or more on this island, only 16 doctors. And she said, throughout it, I only saw two doctors working. The nurses were mean and abusive, and so were some of the doctors. We don't know the extent of the abuse because she doesn't describe it, but one shudders to think not only of physical abuse, but the potential for sexual abuse as well. And so these were just conditions that went back to the Middle Ages, basically. And even though this was 1887, things were a little bit better than they should have been on Blackwell's Island. And so she reported all of these things in a series of articles that were just, they just wowed New York City and the nation at large.
She had to have gotten off the island. How did that happen
before
she could do the reporting?
Yeah, they had a good plan of getting her on the island. Yes. They did not have nearly as good a plan of getting her off. Finally, Joseph Pulitzer hired one of a crackerjack attorney who got her off the island. And that's when the articles started appearing in October of 1887. They were soon syndicated nationally. And they made not only Nellie Bly famous, but they made the horrid conditions on Blackwell's Island quite infamous as well.
So how did that help change? What changes happened because of her writing?
Well, very soon after, there was a grand jury that was impaneled, and a lot of great old men doctors were asked to investigate, and they found the same conditions that Nellie Bly reported. And the city then appropriated $1 million extra per year compared to what they were appropriating. Now, $1 million is a lot now. In 1887, it was really a lot. I mean, it's maybe $100 million, I don't know, but it's quite a lot of money. And so conditions did improve rather quickly after her reports, but there were still issues with asylums around the United States. This was not just, you know, a light switch moment and everything changed. There was still a great deal of work well into the 1930s and 40s in this country with the way the mentally ill were treated, and some might argue until relatively recently.
What are some of the other stories that Nellie Bly covered in her career?
Well, my favorite is that she decided to travel around the world in less than 80 days. And you'll remember
that, Jules Verne.
Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days. Phineas Fogg traveled by balloon. It was a great motion picture in the late 1950s. And she traveled in 72 days. And she did it alone. She didn't have a chaperone. She didn't have a man with her. She traveled all around the world in 72 days and wrote dispatches from all the various places that she was at. The telegraph was around, so these dispatches could be filed from wherever she was to New York City, and that made her quite famous as well.
Is it easy to access her readings too?
Oh, yes. You can either purchase the books very easily because they're still in print, but they're also online. I downloaded 10 Days in a Madhouse just the other day.
That would be, I'm sure, fascinating reading.
It really is.
Give you an eye into what things were like in the late 19th century.
She's a great writer. And then she retired. She married a multimillionaire, a man named Robert Seaman, who owned the Ironclad Manufacturing Company, which made containers. They made boilers, they made containers for foods and so on. And she actually invented a few herself. They even made garbage cans, by the way. And he was 73 when she was only in her 20s. And then she took over the company and ran that. She died, unfortunately, very young of pneumonia. Well, I say she died at 57. I just turned 58 yesterday, so I'm saying she died very young.
She did die very young, trust me.
Yeah.
When we, you know, we think about pioneering trailblazers, and here she is, a pioneering investigative reporter. If you think of the pantheon of people who are
Trailblazers, where would you put Nellie Bly?
In the field of journalism? Oh, my, I'd put her up right up there in the top 10 because she was there first. And the fact that she was a woman doing this at a time where journalism, how do I put it politely, where fake news was far more common than we are led to believe it is today. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of exaggeration and hyperbole. But she's a really remarkable contributor to the great and honorable profession of journalism.
Nellie Bly, born 154 years ago this past Saturday on May 5th. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell, thank you so very much.
Thanks.
It began in Switzerland in 1986 as a way to combat overdose deaths and diseases linked to opioid drugs, safe injection sites, also known as supervised injection sites, a place where users can inject drugs in a clean place with clean needles under medical supervision. Well, the idea spread to other countries through the years, and this January, Philadelphia became the first city in this country to approve privately run safe injection sites. Other cities are sitting up and taking note, including some here in Michigan. But the Drug Enforcement Administration does not approve. Here's Catherine Pfaff, a spokeswoman for the DEA, talking about safe injection sites.
The U.S. drug policy supports evidence-based programs that prevent or reduce drug use and its consequences rather than facilitating safer use of drugs. Safe injection sites and heroin maintenance programs just don't meet that criteria. Any facilitation of illicit drug use is considered in violation of the Controlled Substances Act.
Well, let's turn now to Steve Alsom, who's executive director of the Grand Rapids RED Project. Welcome to Stateside. Good to have you with us, Steve.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Tell us a little bit, please, about your group's mission and the services that you offer in Grand Rapids.
Sure. The organization I work with is called the Grand Rapids RED Project. Our mission is to improve health, reduce risk, and prevent HIV. We really maintain a focus on providing people with access to the knowledge, tools, information, and support that they need to stay healthy, specifically as it relates to HIV, hepatitis C, overdose, and then substance use in general. We provide a variety of services here in the Grand Rapids area. Probably our largest and most long-standing program is our syringe access program, which has been running in Grand Rapids since 2000. When our syringe access program started, approximately 25% of all HIV/AIDS cases in Kent County were related to injection drug use. Currently, that's decreased to 8%. We provide HIV case management, HIV counseling, testing, and referral. We've been doing a lot around overdose prevention response training and equipping community members as well as law enforcement and other folks with naloxone rescue kits to reduce fatality from that public health epidemic.
And the kind of work you're doing, as well as safe injection sites, fall under this umbrella of something known as harm reduction. Would you explain the principles of harm reduction?
Harm reduction is a strategy to reduce negative consequences of substance use. So we have a huge problem nationwide with opioid use right now. The CDC considers overdose to be of epidemic proportions nationwide. It's actually killed more people than automobile accidents. Historically, up until about the last 10 years or so, automobile accidents had been the leading cause of accidental death pretty much everywhere in our country. However, even though people are dying in automobile accidents, we still take small steps to reduce the potential harm that could come to us and others from driving in cars. We do things like drive the speed limit, stop at red lights, stop at stop signs. Those are practical options that we take to reduce harm that could come to us from that potentially dangerous activity while still engaging in it because we find it convenient or for whatever. So harm reduction is basically that same strategy applied to drug use. So we try to provide folks with practical options they can actually utilize, such as, you know, providing individuals with sterile syringes, provide people and train them to use naloxone rescue kits. And then safer injection facilities are also, you know, something that's been used not in the United States yet, but in Canada as well as Europe to reduce, you know, the potential public health harms from drug use in those countries. And they've been shown to pretty effectively reduce the spread of HIV and Hep C, keep people from dying of overdoses, as well as serve as a means to actually get people into substance use treatment.
I'm curious about that because I'm wondering what your response is to what we heard from the DEA spokesperson that safe injection sites, they believe, do not move people towards getting off drugs, towards better health.
It's pretty similar to syringe access in the same way that syringe access programs can lead people to ceasing drug use. Programs like ours and like safer injection facilities, they create honest, open relationships so that when those individuals are ready to get into treatment, we can serve as a place of referral for those individuals. For example, all of our services at RED Project, including syringe access, are run by certified recovery coaches who are individuals who personally have a history of substance use, but help other folks get into treatment as well.
Well, there was another point that the DEA spokesperson made when we talked with her, again, Catherine Pfaff of the DEA. Let's take a listen, then I'll get your thoughts.
What we've seen is that the average length of a stay at a supervised injection facility is about 20 minutes. That just isn't enough time to engage and be motivated to treatment. It's just unrealistic.
Well, what do you think? Does she have a point here?
Not really. You know, that's 20 more minutes that you have with somebody than if they weren't in any facility, first of all. You know, so you're comparing zero time with somebody to 20 minutes. You know, that's a step in the positive direction. Then second of all, you know, a lot of the basis of our programs is creating a relationship over a long period of time. So sure, somebody might spend 20 minutes today in the facility, but then they'll spend 20 minutes tomorrow, 20 minutes the next day. You can create a relationship with that individual over a longer period of time.
And meantime, is it clear that you've seen in the countries that allow these sites, they're staying healthier?
Very much so.
As we were saying, Philadelphia became the first city in the U.S. to say yes to supervised injection sites. That happened earlier this year. The director of Detroit's health department told the Detroit Free Press she thinks it's an idea worth exploring. What do you think is the future for such sites in Michigan? And do you envision safe injection sites might come to Grand Rapids?
I think it's something that we need to investigate everywhere in our country. The opioid issue, the issue with overdose, is very pervasive. It affects rural communities, suburban and urban communities. There's really not an area in our country that is not affected by this issue. So we really need to start building some coalitions around this issue and looking at the evidence base and then discussing as a community whether these are interventions we want to implement. We're certainly seeing a need within the Grand Rapids community, as elsewhere in Michigan.
I'm wondering how you would get something like a safe injection site off the ground in light of the DEA's view that it violates the Controlled Substance Act. What kind of tensions do you envision with the DEA were this to come to pass?
I really couldn't speak to the legality piece with the DEA and such.
Okay, fair enough.
But if anywhere was to provide the service, it would really need to be a coalition, you know, a pretty broad base of support in the community that's working on implementing it together.
I'm curious, Steve, when you were setting up your services in Grand Rapids, did you have to deal with anybody saying, not in my backyard, you know, do what you need to do, but not near me?
Certainly. That's an issue we had to deal with initially when we opened our syringe access program, as well as currently as we seek to expand our program to other areas, you know, of the state where there's a need as well. You know, unfortunately, the way that the NIMBY argument, not in my backyard, falls apart is that these things already are in people's backyards. You know, drug use, opioid use, and overdose are going on everywhere. We're just bringing an additional service to individuals. The substance use is already going on in communities where we're starting these interventions.
Were you able to win over critics once things kind of got up and running?
Yeah, we've been able to. Each one of our programs has a lot of data behind it. Like I mentioned earlier, the success we've had in addressing HIV, we've brought the percentage of Kent County residents who contracted HIV from injection drug use has gone down from 25% to 8% in the time that we've provided a syringe access program here. With our overdose prevention program, we've been providing access to naloxone rescue kits since 2008. Since that time, we've had over 685 folks who have used one of those kits to reverse an overdose in the community and potentially save somebody's life. So as our programs have gotten operational and have run for a sufficient period of time, we've definitely been able to use the data from our programs to show the success of our programs to the communities in which we operate. They literally save lives.
Steve Alsom is Executive Director of the Grand Rapids RED Project as we take a look at safe injection sites for a way of combating the drug overdose deaths and diseases linked to opioid use. Steve, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Sure, no problem.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.